You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast.
My name's Woody Geisman.
And I'm Abby Dean, and we haven't been together on the radio in a long time.
It's been a little while,
yeah.
Abby. Yeah. So reach out to us on Facebook. Our shows are also podcast on our website at right-turn.org. And tonight we're talking about staying sober. The theme of tonight is...
No plan is a plan to fail. And it sounds so corny, and Woody says it all the time, but every intervention you do with somebody who has a problem, you need to have a plan if they choose to do this or if they choose not to do this.
Absolutely. We're talking about the importance of a good aftercare plan after leaving treatment and how to put together a plan to stay clean and sober. And later on in the show, we're going to talk about the families.
Right. So we'll talk, you know, about individuals and what their role is in maintaining sobriety, but also what the family's role is. Because I think a lot of families sit there and say, okay, he's better. Now I don't have to worry anymore.
Right. One of our guests tonight is Terry Cronin, who's a licensed addiction specialist and an interventionist as well, a licensed interventionist. And Terry works with the program Advanced Health and Education, an adult center in New Jersey. And he's also joining us in the studio tonight is also my good friend Frank Norton, who is a community outreach person and marketing for the same program that's Advanced Health and Education. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Thank you.
And we also have Peter C. Johnson, who every now and then, if we get to work early enough, you can hear him play music. He's an alcohol and drug counselor and relapse prevention specialist. What we're bringing him here to, and he's also a musician. What we're bringing him here to talk about is a lot about, you know, what people have to do to stay sober, both for as education, but also for family members to become aware of it. So I want Terry and Peter. So what happens is, somebody comes into treatment, they decide they're sober, they've got 3 days, 5 days a week, and then they're sitting there saying, now what? So how do people maintain sobriety throughout treatment? And do you want to tell us some of the things you talk about, Peter?
Well, sure. There are the obvious things that we always hear about, people, places, and things.
Meaning what?
Avoid the people, places, and things that are dangerous for you, that so you've had a history associated with your drug use.
So you're 22 years old and you have to make new friends?
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, of course, anyone who engages in NAAA Smart Recovery has a leg up as far as ongoing recovery goes. I try to teach our clients a number of daily recovery skills that will be ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
I start that on day one. When people arrive at our doorstep, they're tired. They're pretty badly beaten up. They've had a lot of losses. They've lost jobs, relationships. They usually have some kind of financial issues, and they're physically just exhausted. And they tend to make grand pronouncements at that point.
I'm never going to drink again.
I will never pick up a drink or a drug again. And so from day one, I try to teach them to make some kind of a morning acceptance or surrender every single day.
So they wake up.
Yeah. Well, look, what we find is that 2 or 3 weeks after they've come to us, oh, you know, it wasn't so bad, and I think I'll be okay. You know, a little bit of euphoric recall, the good old days, creeps in. And that desperation is no longer palpable.
Right.
So I try to teach them to spend a minute, 2 minutes, doing some form of acceptance that they are an addict, that this disease will continue to inhabit them in a number of ways. Biologically, spiritually, mentally, and they need to surrender again every single day and acknowledge the fact that if they pick up a drink or a drug, they are choosing to engage in a fight they're not going to win.
Well, it's interesting because you and I, we often, if anybody doesn't make it, we have a conversation when they come back and they say, Peter, you taught me all that stuff and I stopped. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped, you know, doing a surrender every morning. And I think it's one of those things because people forget that this is life and death, and they think it's just they're going to be okay.
Yeah, and they don't always understand. We try to teach them that this is a progressive disease, progressive and fatal. It's in almost every definition of addiction.
Yeah, and I think that's important. The remembering every day. You have some other skills you teach them?
Well, you know, another one is that we know that drug use and alcohol use is very often a response to an uncomfortable emotional state.
Right.
And so what I ask my clients to do and continue doing after their discharge is a daily emotional inventory. I ask them to take their emotional temperature several times throughout the day. The first thing I ask them to do is to try to identify the feeling.
Right.
Remember, please, these are people who have spent sometimes years squashing every feeling that's come along.
Right.
They don't really understand what they're feeling and very often can't identify it. So I ask them to identify it. I ask them to ask themselves, is this even within my control?
Right.
I ask them to try to think about what would help ease these feelings. Should I talk to somebody? Should I seek medical help in the case of a serious depression or anxiety?
Right.
Or will they just pass?
Lots of feelings just pass.
Yes, and I try to teach them as best I can that these feelings and emotions are vital parts of their humanity.
Right. I had a client who started doing this, and she was so enthusiastic, and then she didn't do well for a long time. And she said, you know, I had actually put this kind of random thing on my phone to remind me so I could take my emotional temperature. And she said, and after a while, I was like, I don't need to do that. You know, and it's like, you know, it's so obvious that if you put this first and foremost, and these actually are things you guys can try at home. Mm. So please try them at home, you know, in all parts of your life. So, excuse me. So, Terry, how do you see, you know, so what do you say to people who say, I've got 2-3 weeks, I got this?
First, I want to just say congratulations, Abby and Woody, on the award. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
You know, because I think this is an absolute necessity, is to be able to not only reach the person with a problem, but the family and what they're experiencing at the same time. You know, I mean, it's a regular event. One of the things is, you know, that we see on a regular basis is just the lack of understanding about what addiction truly is. So what we see time and time again is a person that, you know, maybe they went from one substance to another substance and get on to heroin. But what addicts fail to realize is they don't get so much as addicted to the drug as they get addicted to the feeling that the drug gives them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very complacent about that. Like, okay, I won't do heroin. I'll smoke pot or I'll drink alcohol, you know, and not realizing. So, I mean, it's a regular part of that process, you know, the recovery process for them to be able to question it. One of the things you never, ever try to do is get them to that point of being compliant and not telling you what they're thinking. You know what I mean? Because that could be the most dangerous game, is that one of, I'll say all the right things, and when I leave here, I'll do what I want to do.
Right, and I think one of the scariest sentences we ever hear is, yeah, I got this. And even just showing that attitude, because I think what I've seen is people who stay sober longest are people who know that every day they could be felled by this disease.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
And so they come into your program, Advanced Health, and you have anywhere from 30 days to 45 days to kind of start to sprinkle these seeds?
Right. Well, and, you know, the first part of any process is the detox part. You know what I mean? Irregardless of what drug you're doing, you need that downtime to be out of your environment, to get the drug out of your system, to where you begin to get some choices back, to be honest with you. And then the education, a big part of any treatment setting is the education, the insight that they can gain, the understanding that hopefully they'll get out of it, the ability for them to begin to question it, you know, to want to try to understand it. You know, so that's a big part of it. You know, I think most of the studies pretty much will emphasize the fact that, you know, the recovery process really is a necessary piece, which not only treatment, but aftercare and follow-up, that needs to go on for a long period of time.
Our guests tonight are Peter C. Johnson, who's an addiction counselor at Right Turn. He's also a relapse prevention specialist. And our special guest tonight from out of town is Terry Cronin, and he's a licensed addiction counselor. He's also a board licensed interventionist and is a part of the advanced health and education system in New Jersey. So, Terry, welcome back. And listen, I have a question for you. I want to talk about how do you communicate to these people that come into your program about recovery? What do we say to them? What do you say recovery and sobriety is going to look like?
Good question. You know, I mean, it's easy for me to do it because I've been in recovery myself now. And I like to think what worked for me would work for basically anybody. So I think first you have to be able to create an atmosphere where, you know, one of your students or whatever you want to call them are willing to open up with that kind of a dialogue, you know, because, again, if they're playing the rehab game, it's not going to go anywhere. So you really want to encourage them to put out that thought, you know, because the whole purpose is you want to be able to, A, you want to develop a rapport with them. You know, so when I was doing counseling, which I'm not lately, it would be for me meeting that client where they're at, you know, asking them, why are you here? What is it that got you here? What do you need to do, you know, to get back to wherever it is you want to go? And how can I help you with that? You know, but what I need was basically the ability to be honest without that playing the game or without that fear of reprisal, you know, to be able to just get them to be able to put that out there. Mm-hmm. You know, because, I mean, I think one of the biggest disservices I've ever seen was out of that High Times magazine, which is always amazing to me because, you know, that they're always saying this is okay and that's okay and this is okay. And it really goes a long way with the young people and some of their arguments, you know what I mean, and some of their stubbornness to come off that. So I think the whole creative side of the addiction field is being able to have your client feel comfortable, not just in a group process, but in individual sessions, mm-hmm. to encourage them. This is the place for the education. This is the place for you to dry out, to get the drugs out of your system, to begin to see what is going to get you to a spot. Most people, generally, I have found out, are not very happy with where their life's at. And when you ask them what do they see as their future, it's not very good. You know, so it's trying to take that attitude and work with it.
So it might almost be more practical to talk to them about what recovery isn't going to be. It's not going to be all of this continued lying and cheating and having all of your family members angry at you.
Right.
You know.
Right. No, that's a really good point, Woody. I mean, because rarely have I found somebody that is so you know, turned off to the rest of the world, mm-hmm. you know, that they are to some degree, they are embarrassed about what they've put their family through or what they've put their friends through or what they've put their significant other through. So most of them really are. There's that, you know, I don't think people really understand the disease that well. It's, you know, when I was in my active addiction, it felt to me like I had the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other shoulder. And it was such a conflict. You know, thinking that I'm really crazy, but you know, that's the hold that addiction has over you or drugs has over you. Mm-hmm.
So both of you kind of talk about recovery, sobriety, and you know, when you're talking to someone about sobriety? What is recovery? Peter?
Recovery is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to grow into your life. You know, it's as you said, it's a opportunity to get honest. It's an opportunity to laugh, you know, and to do all of the things you dreamed about. Sometimes I'll sit with the client, and I'll ask them to envision what their ideal self looks like, you know, and they'll do that, and they'll kind of like what they're seeing. yeah, you know, with a lot of these young clients, Right Turn does have quite a few kind of 19 to 30-year-old clients. They have a very, very hard time envisioning a life without substances, and it's very hard with a 19-year-old to tell them that smoking pot probably isn't going to work and move them towards that ideal self.
Right.
You know, I'm looking back at my own experiences. I had a nasty cocaine habit that ended 32 years ago. But I thought it was a good idea, you know, to have something.
and that something
was alcohol. And it developed over the years. It progressed into the same kind of, you know, just intense, destructive addiction as the cocaine.
Right.
So, a simple answer to that question is to be a sober man or woman, you don't take anything that excites the pleasure centers of the brain or.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a really hard thing to hear along with people, places, and things when you are 22 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's why I think so many individuals, you know, young, I mean, everybody is like, It's hard to give up everything, and some of the stuff you can't give up. I mean, some people have to keep their jobs, and some people are going to try to keep their wives and their families, and it's really hard to say, okay, change people, places, and things that are your triggers, and what if your trigger, you know, you drink every time you fight with your kids or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, some of them you can't give up, so it's nice to have other things in place.
You know, one of the things I think that all of us as addiction professionals try to focus on and do pretty well these days is really try to help people understand the rocky road ahead of them in early recovery and kind of educate them and help them understand how it's going to be a little bit of a bumpy ride at first, you know, but kind of as we get in further into recovery, things become a little bit better. Things improve.
Right.
Sleeping, you know, the sleeping disturbances go away, and the things that scare us and go bump in the night tend to go away.
Well, it's really interesting because I know all treatment programs, or good ones, start discharge planning the mm-hmm. moment people arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you don't, you know, if somebody has, you really have to get people focusing on where, you know, they're trying to put, somebody's like, well, it's too soon to look at it. But I'm like, I just want to know if you're going to put, you know, one foot in front of each other for a little while, which direction you're kind of vaguely heading in. You're not saying to them, you know, you need to decide if you're going to get your PhD or you're going to go, you know, you're going to become, you know, some, you know, can manage construction. You don't need to decide that, but just you have some idea of the when you leave here, where you're heading. And it's so hard because it's hard to really balance it. But people really mm-hmm. need to think about a direction instead of just running from the addiction. They have to be heading to something.
So it's not so much about worrying about long-term goals, but looking at simple structure. Can we say mm-hmm. looking at how you can structure your day?
This whole process needs to happen in increments.
Okay.
Yes.
Say more.
Well, you know, you're going to get from where you are now to where you want to be in small steps.
You mean you're not going to get sober tomorrow and become a rocket scientist?
Yeah. And a lot of people feel, you know, defeated by the notion that they aren't achieving, you know, they aren't becoming this, that, or the other thing. We had a client recently, you'll remember this, who decided that he wanted to be a doctor, but he hadn't graduated from high school. So we thought that a good goal for him would be to try to get back to high school.
Right. Right. He's very young. He could do it. It was no problem. But it was like slow. Yeah. One at a time.
I think that we should also, in all fairness, you know, the longer that someone's in treatment, the better the outcome. And if someone can go through your program, Terry, and get, you know, some good time together and continue along, that if they can get, you know, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, pretty good outcome. 6 months, even better. But we see the numbers really really increase at 1 year's worth of sobriety, which is right. Such a wonderful thing. So we would encourage people to stay connected and you know, get involved with your sober supports for a whole year. Let's go to the phones. We have Ray on the air. Ray, welcome to Right Turn. You're live on the air.
Hey, how are you guys?
Hi,
hey.
Good, Ray. What do you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask y'all, what do you see as the changes coming up in treatment in this country?
Oh, that's a great question.
That's a great question.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something to debate about we could go on for about hours. But, you know, I would love to be able to see a much more cooperative attitude towards in the addiction, not only in the addiction field, but in the insurance field, in the reimbursement field, of being able to not only just do your what I would call run-of-the-mill treatment, but to really be able to work with a client long enough, you know, over a period of time. You know, we were talking before about the...
Well, that's a really good point.
Yeah, we were talking before about how do we actually get a person to be able to stay? Now, when you think about a young person, you know what I mean? Here we are in treatment, basically telling them, all right, here's the deal. We don't encourage you to drink. We don't encourage you to go to bars. We don't encourage you to go to clubs. You know, no, you can't stay out all night. No, you can't go out and hang out with your old friends. So it becomes a matter of, what can I do? And you can't accomplish that 2 weeks at an inpatient facility of being right. able for them to be able to really, you know, it's like, okay, here you are, 2 weeks, you're done, you're out, goodbye, go home.
Spin right. dry.
You know, yeah,
a
exactly.
Spin dry.
So, and it's, and, you know, you got, people use drugs for a reason, you know, so the future of this, I think where it's going to go is a lot more cooperation between not just the behavioral health field, but the medical field and families being involved, you know, and understanding this and getting involved and, you know, husbands, wives, the whole situation, just really, because there's so much to be accomplished. It's almost like, you know, I know you were saying, Peter, about dealing with a lot of young folks over at Right Turn, and it's, you know, we're not talking rehabilitation for these guys. We're talking habilitation.
Right. It's really, yeah. I mean, right? I think it's just one of those, I like that. That's a good way of looking at it. You're teaching people how to do things for the first time.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to, you have to be nice to your clients. I think that's one of the things, the whole, you have to treat them with respect. I mean, you can tell them what they've been into, but there's this whole tradition of kind of yelling at people and, you know, kind of breaking them down and building them up again. And I think that people do better if you're nice to them.
Yeah.
But, and the family inclusion is so important. If we could just get rid of the stigma, you know, I mean, if, you know, here's all the, I think... You know, here's all these people who are really, really struggling with addiction, and it's not just them. It affects all of us every day. And it's, you know, I have so many families come into the office and say, well, I didn't tell anybody because I'm so ashamed. And finally they come out and tell somebody, and then, you know, three people at work said, oh, my, thanks for saying that. I'm going through the same thing, and it becomes a conversation. But there's so much stigma, so I think we really mm-hmm. have to address mm-hmm. that. I think more people who are in recovery have to come out in recovery.
Right.
Well, and Tara, you mentioned family as being more of a component of treatment.
Oh, I mean, I think, Woody, you're talking about an extremely essential piece of treatment. You know, when I was working with adolescents, I'd have families that would pull up to the door, drop their child off, and basically say, he's yours, see you in a month or two. You know, it's like, whoa, 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 stop. You know, you need to be involved, because we can't implement anything without your cooperation or without your understanding. You know, and all the years of doing interventions, you know, Mrs. Delaney up at Lena Lodge, just to get off of that just for a second, used to say, the families can undo in 10 minutes what it took us a year to do. They can undo it that quickly.
Right.
You know, basically because... You know, for whatever reason, whether it's their own issues, whether it's what we love to call codependency issues, you know, but family has to be involved. I mean, we have really tried to beef up our family program at Advanced Health only because it's so essential. And I learned that with adolescents. If we didn't have family involved, It's the old rusty can theory. You know, you take a rusty can out of the rain, you polish it up, and you put it right back in the rain. You know, nothing's changed.
Right.
It goes right back to that.
Yeah, and families need to do a lot of the changing, and that's really, it's really hard because they've, you know, adapted to having someone who's non-functional in their, or not very functional in their lives, and then they have to somehow adapt to how they're going to help this new person who's emerging, and it's just a really painful process. Right. Peter.
Yes, and I think a lot of the families still view this as some kind of a moral issue, that they need to be educated about addiction.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that this is not, I remember a father saying, I finally realized that he is not doing this to me. That we both have the same enemy. We're both fighting the same thing. And we're on the same side. And that was just a really powerful moment. He's right. Not doing this right. To me.
You know, if I could add to that, Terry, I think it's wonderful, the idea, the notion that we could, well, have insurance companies, you know, recognize the need for longer, people staying in treatment longer, but also the notion of keeping people in treatment long enough so that they can kind of get through those underlying issues and kind of get through all of that and be in a structured program so that they can begin to get well enough along with the families to start to look at, like, concepts of 12-step recovery. You said before off the air you love to ask families to go to Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
And how important is that?
Right. No, I mean, when I was doing interventions, I would try to I would really almost insist that you attend, you know, Al-Anon or Naranon or some of these other self-help, self-support groups, just so they could get the identification from other families of, I've been where you're at. You know, and the resistance I would run into, you know, and the most effective way I found to be able to turn that around was to say to the families, and yet you expect me to convince your son to go to treatment and then go to, you know, a 12-step recovery program, and I can't even get you to go one night a week. You know, how effective am I, you know?
So everybody's talking right now about, like, all these great ideas they're throwing around, you know, family, 12 steps. What does a good discharge plan look like? What is a good, doable discharge plan? Uh-oh.
Let's throw Frank
in
here.
Frank
Norton.
Hello. My idea of a good discharge plan would be to obviously get him set up with a therapist, perhaps maybe a psychiatrist. Definitely get them hooked up with an IOP, intensive outpatient program.
Which is at least 3 days a week.
At least 3 days a week, correct. In some cases, we can even get them set up with partial programs back in the community. sober living. Sober living, I think, is a good part of a discharge plan as well. Living with a bunch of other sober companions. Finding the right sober house is very important, you know, location, and hopefully get them back into working in society and maintaining a good sober life.
So a lot of structure is really important.
Absolutely. Structure is very important.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that people are like when left, all of us, when left to ourselves with no structure after, like, you know, homesick for a week or something, you're falling apart. So structure helps maintain people's health.
And I like what you said earlier, Abby, about not setting long-term goals too quickly.
But set some goals.
Set goals, but really try to focus on, you know, what's going to be your sober support network, Peter, right? What's going to be your sober support network? Who's going to be in who's going to be your tribe?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, at Right Turn, the clients who are most successful are those who have remained engaged in Right Turn. They come to our musical events and they, you know, drop by. Some of them come back to speak.
Yeah.
You know, they stay connected.
To their meetings and to Right Turn and wherever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're listening to Right Turn Radio. We're going to come back and we're going to have more about families and what it looks like to have long-term recovery.
So Frank just spoke a lot about, you know, what a discharge plan looks like from the inside, you know, for the individual. What does a good discharge plan look like? What's a family discharge plan? What does the family have to do differently? And is it different when someone's been, you know, 3 days in a detox versus, you know, 3 months versus a year somewhere?
Other than a moment of brevity, but I always encourage family, change the locks and move and don't tell them where you're going. but that's not realistic for most families. The more a family's involved, yeah, let me throw something out there. There's in the past, when you look at success stories, you know what I mean? And one of the most success stories you ever look at is within the physician's health program. And mm-hmm. it's because of the mandatory participation that must go on. So where families involved, the more the families, whether it's mom or dad, husband or wife, the more they implement the structure that basically says you are going to follow your aftercare plan to the letter and not drink or drug under my roof. If they can do that, you know what I mean? Then you've got a real shot at being able to do this.
You know, Terry, our lines just lit up here. Let's go to the phones. Let's first go to Chris. Chris, you're live on the air with Abby and Woody.
Hi, my name is Chris Schroeder. My question would be, why does it seem like there's so much money available for other forms of psychiatric or medical conditions, and the families that I work with so often find that insurance and other reimbursement is almost insufficient, almost always insufficient for addiction treatment.
Hmm. Huh, Terry? Good question. Thanks, Chris.
We're sitting
welcome to
here.
The
wow.
radio. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, why is there
show.
So, let me see if I got a good handle on it. Why is there so much available for mental health and not much for addiction? Is that correct?
Yeah, he's
gone. Oh, he's gone. Yeah. Okay. All right, pretty much. God, I think a lot of it is stigma. I think Abby talked about that
earlier.
It's
a moral disease.
Right.
It's,
right.
The
other part of that, and it's almost like I'm worried about saying this out loud, but what the heck? I'm old enough to get away with it, I think. It's just, I think the stigma of being an addict is that the belief system is addicts don't recover.
Mm.
So why throw money after good, you know, good money after bad?
Yeah, but Terry, I'm going to you know, I just recently interviewed Patrick Kennedy about the Parity Act and how we are trying to match mental health services with addiction services. And I think Abby said it too. There's a stigma there, but we're trying to raise the level of awareness for addiction services and put it up on the level with any other mental health issue. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Curtis.
Okay. Go ahead, Curtis. You're on the air. What's
Curtis, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Hi, this is Dave Curtis calling. I have a question for Terry Cronin. Terry, when working with adolescents and you're talking about aftercare, what are the best tools in terms of aftercare monitoring and trying to make sure that individuals comply with the program once they leave a treatment center?
Good question. Is he gone now?
No, he's still there. So you haven't.
Hey, thanks, Dave, for your question. It's a good one. Adolescent treatment is for the most part, is sorely lacking. No matter where you go,
yes.
It really is. And insurances are very reluctant to pay for it. They don't mind paying to see a counselor, a psychiatrist, a therapist. You know, but the problem there is that there's really you're in that environment. Oh, you're in that environment where you know insurance. You know where. I mean, imagine trying to stay sober or clean in a school setting. You know, it's darn near impossible. Some of the schools have implemented a support group, a structure for them. Not all schools, but some have.
Yep.
There are some more and more places are looking into sober schools, so where kids almost like a boarding school.
Yeah, we have sober high schools here.
Right, exactly.
They're great.
You know, so the attempts are being made to do that, but... It's I've had parents come to me in the past basically and say something about, well, I'd like to send my son or my daughter so-and-so to this place. And it's generally very expensive and the reputation is generally very good. But the reality of that situation is unless the family's on board with that 100% and working with that and putting that structure into that aftercare setting when they get out, chances are they're going to have to go through it again. You know, I don't know what the statistic is on adolescents, but it's somewhere ballpark 2.5, 3.5 rehabs before they...
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, all of this is insurance-driven, and mm-hmm. we're saying we want parity. I mean, I think we should, you know, and the idea of what parity is and what it isn't is kind of a little insane, because it's like, that means you get one therapy session a week and, you know, maybe 2 weeks of inpatient. And it's not treating what the people need. If someone has diabetes, they still will treat the person until they get better. Mm. And the mm-hmm. idea of what better is for addiction yeah. means you're not using drugs. Well, if you're inpatient, you're not using drugs.
Yeah, right. Great point, Abby. Let's go. We have time for one more caller. Bobby, you're live on the air with Abby and Woody. How are you, Bobby?
It's Robbie.
Oh, sorry, Robbie.
That's okay. I had a question for Terry in regards to how the community can best support the process and aftercare when finishing treatment.
Can you say that again, Robbie?
How can the rehab community best support the process post-treatment?
How can rehabs support the process? One of the things we've been able to do, we've been very fortunate, especially with our young folks, is being able to locate them in halfway houses and sober houses near us so they can continue on with us 3 days a week. We also have the Alumni Association. But I think you'll find that with a lot of rehabs. They try to have an alumni association. They try to have a family program. And a lot of times that family program can continue after the adolescent
yes.
or the adult has gone home. You know what I mean? Because
really
they continue need that. They continue to need that structure. Thank you, Robbie.
So, I think we basically have come up with the perfect discharge plan, what it looks like. You know, it has to include family. It has to include structure for the person. It has to include safe, sober housing and community supports, AANA, some things like that, or just, you know, the community supports. But the family has to be involved, and family has to be on board for it to work. I'd really like to thank our guests. Thank you, Peter Johnson. Thank you. Thank you. Frank, the reluctant interviewee, and Terry Cronin for being, and thank you.
Thank you, folks.
And Hope Advanced Health Systems has a lot of fun. and I'm a Jerseyite, so yay, New Jersey. That's
yeah.
where they're located.
Let's talk about some things coming up in the community. I mean, I want everyone to remember that September is Recovery Month, and so you should be checking your calendars. There's things, activities going off at the State House. Also, put on your calendar, November 15th, it's a special comedy show with Tony V at the Regent Theater with Jack Lynch.
Oh, I love
it's going to be a night of comedy for comics for recovery.
But one of the things Right Turn does is it has music, sober music, every weekend. And next weekend coming up is Roma Dogs. It's a mixture of Indian classical and American backbeat rock, but an amazing tabla player. Which I never thought I'd say that sentence, but I've heard them.
Yeah. Also, the following week there's a AA conference in town, and the young people of AA are hosting an open mic for anyone who wants to come and perform at Right Turn. So that's 299 Broadway. Just check out our website, Google Right Turn, and you'll find us. You guys, again, thank you so much. And
thanks, Jill Ruby.
And Jill Ruby, thank you so much. And Ed Sweeney, thank you so much for making our show
great.
Great.
Don't forget, be safe and ask for help.
Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.